Very good. Thank you very much. Well, it's hard actually to talk about Eve Stripe 2 after Eve's command performance yesterday, talking about Eve Stripes and development. In fact, I really got my start and from him. My background is in population genetics, although I did it on the fly. And it certainly is the case that anyone that does population genetics on the fly and isn't really doing genetics suffers a certain amount from genetics envy. And this project, and to be able to produce the beautiful kind of picture Steve was showing and study embryogenesis, really kind of satisfies that want. So I've been pulled into this field. But it's fair to say that this is true, that Steve has certainly forgotten more than I know about this subject. And I doubt Steve has forgotten very much. Just to say, I don't really know too much. And so I'm sure you'll ask me a lot of questions, and I'm sure Steve will be happy to answer them. But I'm going to talk about Eve Stripe 2. This is really just to point out, let me start this. That all the work I'm talking about is really the work of my colleague Michael Ludwig, who is a Russian expatriate and a very, very talented Drosophila molecular geneticist. In some ways, all this work seems very easy, but for those of you who haven't done it, it requires quite a bit of training in a number of different areas. I mean, you have to become facile just in basic Drosophila genetics and Drosophila husbandry. This involves doing a fair amount of crossing, depending on how sophisticated you want to get. And you have to be a relatively good molecular biologist to make various constructs. And perhaps even more technical is to be able to transform these fly embryos through injections. And then, you know, you have to be a good embryologist to be able to get the data. So the truth is, there's not that many people who do this, I would say, right? And perhaps it's for that reason. But Misha, if you call him, is really a phenomenally good molecular geneticist. The work is also, I'll talk about the second half of the talk, is that from Susan Lott, who is a graduate student working on this subject. I shouldn't say it's on catalyzation, but I hope it's related to catalyzation in any case. Okay, let me just start out by pointing out that we saw a different version of this same cartoon yesterday from Steve, but there's two components of gene regulation. One are the trans factors, and the other is the cis regulatory module. And there's actually been conflicting views about the relative importance of the two components in evolution, although it hasn't been advertised very much. Perhaps Steve and most molecular geneticists would tend to focus on these cis-regulatory sites and cis-regulatory modules as the component of the system that's more likely to evolve and to be important in understanding evolutionary change. And I should say, at this point, with a few exceptions, the jury's still out about what the relative importance of cis-regulatory evolution is in phenotypic evolution in general. In fact, the whole issue originated with Eric Davidson a long time ago when he worked with Britton and Davidson doing COT curves that you... It may not even be in textbooks anymore, it's so old. But long before you could sequence DNA, you could anneal different fractions of, for example, DNA purified from chimp and human, and look at the annealing kinetics of the single copy component. And they did a lot of work, and they were one of the first to really show convincingly, but indirectly, that human and chimps barely differ at the DNA level. And I think Eric was the first one to propose, this was a long time ago, that as a result of that very small amount of change at the genetic level, there must be some mechanisms that amplify those small number of changes to produce the large morphological, physiological, developmental differences we see between humans and chimps. They did on single copy, and you know, I forget the details, but the basic idea is there's a lot of repetitive DNA, and so when you try to do a look at annealing kinetics, the first thing that anneal are all the repetitive DNA, one to itself. And so what they do is they first do these annealings to try to get rid of all of the highly repetitive component and take it to a point where they think they're down to the unique copy DNA. And it's that component that they then anneal one to another to look at those annealing kinetics. Yeah, yeah, that's right. I mean, I think, right, on these columns. And so, right. But he was first to propose, therefore, that perhaps the real important changes are regulatory and not structural. And that idea was popularized further by the late Alan Wilson, who is a biochemist. And became a famous molecular evolutionist at Berkeley. And he's associated with the molecular clock hypothesis. And in his view, the molecular clock was driven by neutral evolution, the fact that if mutation rates occur at a relatively constant rate and changes are neutral, then evolution, molecular evolution occur at a relatively constant rate. And so he really wasn't of the belief either that structural proteins had a lot to do with morphological or adaptive evolution. And so he bought into and also popularized the idea that regulatory evolution must be really important. But it just kind of sat there. No one knew about how gene regulation worked in eukaryotes, and no one could really do anything about it. Once we learned about it, there's obviously these two components, and one view is that the cis-regulatory component is important. But if you think about the Evo-Devo people who study, I would say, you know, how arthropods got their claws or lobsters got their claws and why different appendages or body segment plans change, they tend to focus on the HOX genes. And they're looking for the presence or absence of a particular HOX gene expression pattern dictating what the actual body plan will look like, so they tend to focus on the trans component as being critical to explain major morphological shifts. And that debate has not been resolved either. Nisha's view is that it's all way too complicated to ever figure out. I'm actually going to first talk about some older work we've done, just to try to learn about how a cis-regulatory module evolves. And then I'm going to talk about more recent work we've been doing, trying to ask questions about how the segmentation responds to genetic variation for egg size, as I'll show you. So let me. Computer's getting a little bit old. Some of the slides are pretty dense, but I have no idea why I'm not. Yeah. Sorry about that. Here we go. Now hopefully it won't just switch. So just a couple of slides to review again. Cis-regulatory modules in mammals occur upstream in introns, downstream. I think Eric is absolutely correct nowadays. If you actually look at large introns, it's easy to show that they are more constrained, their sequence, evolve at slower rates than small introns. And in a way, it's surprising, because by small introns, I mean, if you look at introns like 100 bases or smaller, and the smallest introns that exist are more or less around 50 base pairs, and they do have certain constraining sequences at the borders, and in order to form lariat structures. So we know there's some constraints, and when you're only talking about a small one, you'd think that would impose itself, and one might see actually slightly slower rates of evolution for these very small introns. But in fact, and the big ones you think are just filled with junk, but in fact, if you do evolutionary analyses, big ones tend to evolve slower than small ones, and they probably are loaded with regulatory sequences in the middle. No one has thought much about this, but of course, yeast tend to fall somewhere in between what bacteria do and what other higher eukaryotes do. And there's obviously been some evolutionary jump between situations where most of the regulation occurs through kind of relatively simple or a number of copies of a certain element that tend to be located directly upstream from the proximal promoter. Obviously, this is an important innovation, but it'd be interesting for someone to study this. So I'm going to talk about a good friend, Eve, and focus on Eve Stripe 2. Again, just recall, I spent a few seconds with that. There's this beautiful hierarchy of transcriptional regulation, a set of maternal genes, bicoid, and maternal hunchback, turn on a set of gap genes that are expressed in broad domains across the embryo. So this is sort of anterior to posterior along the embryo. Those then, these combinations are responsible for turning on a set of gap genes that produce these beautiful seven-stripe patterns, of which EvenSkip is one of the so-called primary pairwheel genes, primary in the sense that its expression also is involved in regulating especially some of the other pairwheel genes. And then these, in turn, turn on segment polarity genes, such as engrailed, and I'll show you some pictures of those. I'm doing this slide because we were talking about it yesterday. This is from this, the book is now at least 92, so 15 years old. But I think it's still good reading for those of you who don't know about Drosophila but want to get an introduction to it. It's a beautiful book. But this just illustrates the developmental progression through the first part of embryogenesis. This goes through 10 hours, starting with a fertilized egg with a single nucleus. As Steve was saying, there's a series of these rapid cell divisions somewhere around the ninth cell division. These nuclei, which, as Steve pointed out, are initially interior to the egg, are in a way that's poorly understood, start migrating or pulled towards the surface to form this nice kind of mono layer of nuclei. Then in this, at around 2.5-3 hours, cellularization, and this is in the 14th cleavage cycle, these membranes start to form. So this is the cortex region, and this just illustrates how these cell membranes start to propagate and extend from this kind of basement membrane along beneath the chorion up to this inner membrane and eventually form these nice columnar cells. Okay? And at this point, one has a fully cellularized blastoderm embryo. One of the nice things about studying development at this stage is that it is a single cell monolayer. Once one gets beyond this point and gastrulation initiates, Steve talked about head invagination, germ band extension, then it becomes multi-layered and trying to analyze the patterns of expression becomes somewhat more complicated. But at this stage, it's really very easy. What's that? Can you Can you arrest it at this?
Well,
all of this development, the only thing I know, Steve may know more, but no one does it, but if you do freeze them or make them much colder, the process slows down. But what we do is we just fix them, you kill them. No, you know, as Steve was saying, and again, I'm not an expert in this, but all this occurs so fast, even if you introduce profound mutations that are absolutely going to kill this embryo, a lot of these cells and processes just keep going. And they'll make it almost through the end of embryogenesis. And but they won't hatch out as larvae. So even some of the kind of profound mutants make it through to the end of embryogenesis. So I think it's hard to actually, you know, put in a mutation that actually freezes the development of the thing. I thought I'd show you this. We were talking a little bit about the cell formation. And I should point out that this is actually quite useful because as these membranes move, you can actually use this as a marker for the developmental stage. Because as Steve showed, when you analyze stripes, the stripes are dynamic and they actually are moving. And so if you want to compare different genotypes, it's important that they be aged to be the same. And one can actually use this as a marker to gauge what the relative age is, or the developmental stage. And so we do that. Reinitz was the one who kind of popularized the use of that and the actual staining patterns such that we can actually take a set of embryos, you know, when you Steve made it sound easy, but actually they have the running joke that sometimes you can spend days trying to find the typical embryo. But we do statistical analyses and we try to find 50 of them, and you look at an awful lot of those embryos and stage them using that kind of criteria. We think we can stage them to about 6-minute time intervals during that developmental process. So here's our friend Even Skip. The locus is about 16 kilobases. It runs smack up almost against two other genes. This is Eve. Someone named them Adam and Apple. And you can see, actually, we were talking about this as well, some of these elements are much, much closer to the start of transcription to these neighbors than they are to the Eve promoter, but they're very selective. And here's a cartoon like one you saw from Steve showing all these binding sites, almost all of which were identified by footprinting, or all of which were identified by footprinting and then confirmed by mutational analysis as Steve described. I think this actually shows a slightly broadened enhancer compared to the one Steve was talking about. And in fact, you know, classically, the definition of an enhancer is sort of the smallest piece of DNA that, when isolated and hooked to a reporter gene, produces a pattern of expression that looks like the native gene's pattern of expression. And so in Levine's lab, Steve and these guys did that, and they got a piece that I think started about there, right? And when Steve said there was one hunchback site, I guess it's that hunchback. So from there, and this picoid one site. And that's about 460 base pairs. But if you look at the evolutionary patterns of conservation and actually the footprinting, things like that, there are some additional sites downstream and upstream. And that's invariably the case for most of these kind of compact cis-regulatory modules that people look at. You can define a functional piece that is somewhat smaller than what you would predict if you, by sometimes either footprinting or by sequence comparison, one often finds some additional sites or binding site prediction. There are additional sites kind of lurking in the periphery. But Steve, probably almost everything he showed you on the strike two was with this 460 base pair piece. It really does reproduce, you know, the native pattern quite nicely. And yet there are more sites that are that probably constitute the full enhancer.
So,
in fact, it may have been fortuitous that they did that, because by not being complete, it may have kind of been more sensitized to do analysis in mutants. Yeah. Of a reporter. Mm-hmm. So all the work I'm going to tell you about involves a larger piece, which we think includes the entire enhancer. And as it turns out, this Kupel 6 site is part of a kind of a larger bit of conserved DNA. We don't know what that additional conservation is doing. And also, somewhere below here, actually, from here all the way is about 1,000 bases or a little less to the start site. So the proximal promoter starts coming in. As I'll show you, a lot of this is quite conserved. So for us, I'm going to tell you about evolutionary analyses of this sequence from different species. But there are nice, completely conserved sequences at both borders that allow us to know we've pulled out a precisely identical piece of DNA. It would be harder if there were insertion deletions here to know that you had the same piece. That's not the case. And just to review again, the model that Steve and others in the lab came up with based on their experimental work is that Bicoid and Hunchback are activators of strike 2 expression. They have those multiple binding sites, and that Giant in the anterior and Kupel posteriorly repress expression and then are responsible for forming the anterior and posterior borders of the stripe. And I suppose to a first approximation, that's still kind of a correct model. So what's the, yeah? There have been some identified, and people have worked with them. And actually, I think in some of the stuff you guys do, you know, they'll stick those sequences in, especially when you're making transgenes. Sometimes you put these insulators just to try to make sure that the gene you're popping somewhere randomly in the genome isn't strongly influenced by surrounding DNA. So something is known. We haven't found that to be a big problem. So here's the problematic. This is an alignment of the, this is the stripe 2 region. So here's that Kupel 6 site. Here's that Hunchback 1 site. We call this block 1 and block 2, these two completely conserved pieces. And here's alignment of melanogaster, Yacuba, erecta, and pseudo-obscura. And for those of you who don't know, I don't know if you can just see over here, everyone knows about Drosophila melanogaster. It has a sibling species that's morphologically identical. You can actually, from the male genitalia, or one feature in the male genitalia, distinguish melanogaster males from simulans males, but the females are morphologically identical. At the sequence level, I always like to gauge divergence by sequence divergence. And if one looks at silent sites, or sequences that you think are relatively unconstrained and evolving roughly at the neutral rate, they differ by 5 to 10% at the DNA level. Then there's Simulans actually has two very closely related relatives. Both of them are island endemics. One is from the Mauritius Islands, that's called Mauritiana, and the other is called Seychellia because it's from the Seychelles. And I'm going to be talking about all three of these species. These two species only diverged a very short time ago, and they're essentially undiverged at the DNA level. That is to say, Seychelles looks like it was a founder event in the sense that all the flies that you can collect for Seychellia are essentially invariant at the DNA level. There's virtually no polymorphism in the species. So it obviously underwent a severe bottleneck, perhaps a founder event, like a single fertilized female blown across from Africa to the Seychelles, and founded this island population, which then quickly speciated. But it is a good species in the sense that hybrids are either sterile or inviable. But fortunately, not completely so. That is to say, in one direction, you can cross Simulans females to Seychellia males, and that mating goes fine, and you can get fertile F1 offspring that you can then either cross with each other or generally cross back to Simulans. So these appear to be good. They are good species, undoubtedly, but they are kind of in an early stage subsequent to speciation. And on the DNA level, there's essentially no DNA divergence.
So what
you know, it could be a subject of one of these whole meetings, but because they have this property, and then the other species, Mauritiana, is the same. There has been a lot of work done on the genetics of post-mating isolation. And in fact, some of the genes that are responsible for that post-mating, that hybrid sterility, for example, have been cloned, but were genes that hadn't been characterized before and are still functionally not well characterized. But there has been a little bit of a cottage industry to try to map and clone, and in some cases successfully, some of the genes. But it hasn't really led to a lot of insight about what's going on. It follows Haldane's rule. There's some rules about how these things, you know, generally, when you have these closely related species, if they cross, it's almost always the case that if there is either sterility or inviability, it occurs in the heterogametic sex rather than the homogametic sex. That is to say, in this case, males rather than females. And this follows that rule very nicely. And in fact, there is right. There is an estimate of the divergence between these two based on a fair amount of sequence data. Now, of course, these entire genomes have been sequenced, but they haven't been put to a good analysis yet. But they place the age at a few hundred thousand years. I'm not at all convinced that it is anything like that. And the reason is that Simulans is a highly polymorphic species. And so if you take any two Simulans, they differ at every single gene, one from another. And there's a lot of recombination in flies, so you get all kind of every possible recombination between different alleles from different genes. This Seychellia is a founder event. It is just like taking one individual. And if you take this individual and compare it to one individual of Simulans, it's really going to differ in the same way that one Simulans differs from another Simulans. So if I put another Simulans line here, it would just go like that as well. So I think you'd have to look at a lot of Simulans alleles, that is, large samples. And my guess is in almost every case, you'll find the exact same allele present in Seychellia. But if you only look at one Simulans, you may not pick up that same allele. it may differ by 1% or 2% or 0.5%, just because that's how much polymorphism is in the ancestral population. So this is just kind of segregation of ancestral polymorphism in the population that gave rise to Seychellia. And that hasn't been analyzed in very good detail. They're really very young. But that's not to say they don't have fixed differences. They do have fixed differences, because Seychellia has some very interesting adaptations. For example, it breeds on this tree called Morinda, or fruit called Morinda. If you ever ever have looked at that or smelled that fruit, it really smells like rotten eggs. It's really kind of putrid. And if you try to let simulans breed on that, it kills them. It's extremely toxic to simulans. But Seychellia has obviously adapted to it. So there must be some adaptive fixed differences between the species. The basic notion is that they have large population sizes, and the standing levels of polymorphism, almost however you measure it, by the number of segregating sites or by nucleotide diversity or heterozygosity, or is under the neutral theory a product of population size and mutation rate. That's the basic neutral theory. The standing crop of variation is the product of population size and mutation rate. And the reason is that population size gets larger, genetic drift gets smaller, and mutations stay around in the population for longer and longer and longer, and they build up a lot of polymorphism. So the first approximation is simply believed that flies have big population sizes, and so they support a very large amount of polymorphism. But I didn't really want to get into that. Most species of flies are quite highly polymorphic. They're about 20 to 50 times or even 100 times more polymorphic than humans, for example. Well, as I say, Seychellia really is essentially invariant, and looks like it underwent spotlight. Mauritiana, not the case. It has quite a bit of polymorphism, and again, it looks like it's segregating for more or less the same set of allelic variants that simulans is. But I want to just point this out, because we're going to talk about these two species, and also we did some genetic analysis that I'll show you between these two. But again, all of these are sort of 5 to 10% diverged. And then there is another branch with two clades, Yacuba, and another called Tessieri. And then coming off there is another clade you can't see called Erecta, one, and Arena. So that's essentially the entire species group. It turns out, just as in this situation, recently another species was discovered here called Santa Maya. It's simply found at the top of one mountain in eastern Africa. But it's a good species. And so it actually makes a nice contrast between these two. But I'm going to talk about Erecta as well. And Erecta is more or less in this 15 to 20% sequence divergence, Erecta compared to melanogaster or simulans. Then, if you go further out, there's another species, Drosophila pseudo-obscura, which many of you have heard about. It has, at the DNA level, divergences of on the order of one hit per site, which is close to human-mouse divergence time. So I don't know what that converts to in real time or geological time, but it has, at the genome level, about the same amount of sequence divergence as human to mouse. And then there are groups outside of these, and I'll show you a couple of, like Drosophila virilis, which is popular, popularly used by some molecular geneticists, and Hawaiian Drosophila go outside, and those are quite old. I mean, probably at least 100 million years old. So I'm just trying to give you some time scale, because I'm going to show you some data.
Lot of genetic variation, a lot of polymorphism. And in fact, it's
Rishana, yeah.
Right. They're not very different from what you get from Fort Walker's and the Indians. But they call it a species because if you try to make them a similar species, then birds are horrible.
Or sterile, or, right.
And what about if you take random strains of stimulants? Yeah, you also get a reasonable fraction of the time they cannot mate, they can always mate.
Yeah.
Is it very surprising or?
You know, that's what you find, typically. That's right. And there are some fixed differences. I'm not claiming there aren't any, but just typically, at least, you know, there's a lot of shared polymorphism. I really, just to point out that these are in the very early stages following speciation. And they have the convenient property that they're not, at least in one direction, the cross produces fertile, viable offspring, allowing you to do genetic analysis. That was done with melanogaster. And this is really surprising. But male and sim, they're 5 to 10% diverged. They are, you know, sterile and inviable in both directions, and you just can't do much. You can make F1s, but the F1s say they're sterile or inviable, and so fine. But in the case like where they're just sterile, you can get adults out. So you can get F1, so you can do at least genetics to that. And there's some tricks that you can do to go a little further. But actually, this just happened in the last 10 years. People just screened just naturally occurring lines, and they found some lines that rescued both the lethality and the sterility in these quite highly diverged lines. And you can actually cross them and produce fertile, viable F1s. It is the case, and maybe this speaks to the epistatic evolution, that even though you can get fertile, viable F1s, there's a lot of breakdown in the subsequent generations as those two genomes start, you know, sorting out one another. But it's going to take too long to... Okay, but so really what I want to... So what's the problematic? It's really this. Here are these sequences. Male, Yacuba, Erecta, and on the bottom, Pseudo-Obscura. And this is just an alignment of these stripe 2 element DNA regions. And highlighted in purple are all what look to be moderately conserved blocks. And also indicated by these black lines are the places where binding sites have been mapped. And actually, there's a pretty good correspondence. Most of the places where there's binding sites, there's conservation. But in many cases, the conservation extends beyond binding sites. And in one case, for example, this sloppy pair, there was this beautiful conserved, completely conserved bit, which originally they didn't know had a transcription factor binding to it. But this was an obvious clue that something was missing. And subsequently, they identified sloppy pair as binding to this site. But so it's pretty good correspondence. But we have talked a little bit about the spacing and the evolution of spacing. And you can see the spacing changes like mad, okay? I mean, you can see big deletions between every single binding site in these species. It's also, so the question really is, you know, all flies make stripes. This is a primary pair rule gene. It's absolutely essential for development. It's one of those genes that you really ought to predict, or cancer sequence should be quite well conserved functionally. But at the DNA level, it's not so obvious. I mean, this is not like a protein. If you look at, you know, a conserved housekeeping gene or something like that, you know, you don't have to do histone, but just a typical functionally conserved gene, like most housekeeping genes, and compare Pseudo-Obscura to melanogaster, there'll be a few amino acid substitutions, but they'll be, you know, very well structurally conserved. It's not so obvious how much structural conservation. And we were very interested in this because of these beautiful experiments Steve didn't talk about, or he alluded to, that he did, and then his successor, Dave Arnosti, where they did knock out all these binding sites, but in many cases they actually replaced them, where they would knock out one binding site and they'd take a weak site and make it into a stronger site, or they moved a site. And they actually showed that they could rescue quite a bit. When they kind of knock out function, they could rescue. And it really left the impression that there's a lot of flexibility, perhaps, in how these things could be designed. And so it's just really not clear. Is this just all running in place and not functionally evolving at all, or is there really some functional evolution here? And can we study these sequences functionally and learn something about the rules governing how these things evolve? Obviously, these kind of sequences are very different from protein sequences, and one would like to know something about the rules. And so that's a big part of our work, has been to try to discover. Yeah, we believe these are all the sites. Oh, no. Now let me. I'm going to talk about that extensively. So. Yeah, so, you know, this has these overlapping Bicoid hunchback sites, a Bicoid and a giant site, and the conservation ends, so.
So I think this is the kind of thing that we'd be interested in looking at, you know, for if the grammar is more than just adding up Bicoid sites, then the sensitivity, when you look for signatures like this, where we don't see any
signatures. I agree, yeah. Well, actually, I have no idea. I believe we have all the sites marked on here, unless we forgot one. I don't believe so. So there's a conserved site there that is not, unless somehow in this picture, and I don't believe so. We just forgot to put the name of a binding site there. I don't believe so, but that's right. And there are some other ones here. So perhaps there's more going on. But, and I think Steve has always said there's more going on here. We don't have the complete story. And there's some suggestion that that's true. Well, as I say, this sloppy pear site was discovered just that way. They originally knew that there were four factors. They mapped them and later discovered that there was one that corresponded to that site. So one could imagine they'll find, eventually there'll be a couple more. No, you know, we're going to do that now. And we've been doing this for a long time, but we've been reluctant to make those kind of specific mutations just because they differ in so many ways. We felt it would be just haphazard to start doing these experiments. They're quite time consuming, they're tedious, and we wanted to know a lot more before we designed those kind of experiments. We know a lot more now, and we're actually doing that. you know, in a much more sophisticated way than...
I would like to read any question.
Yeah.
Do you also have polymorphic sites?
Yeah, I'll talk about that a little bit.
Would be like natural experiments.
Yeah, that's right. We do find polymorphic sites. And actually, in the Stripe 3.7 enhancer, there is a polymorphic deletion that takes out a highly conserved binding site, and it's segregating the population, and we can't actually, we've looked, we can't detect any kind of phenotypic effect of it. So there is polymorphic. Let me just go on quickly. This is just shows one of these VISTA plots. This is through a little bit bigger region. This is the upstream region starting at the start site for the gene, stripe 2, stripe 3 plus 7. This is what Steve called the late element, sometimes used to be called the autoregulatory or AR element. And they're highlighted in blue. This is a picture of the divergence. So up at this top line is 100% conserved. Down here, I guess, it's probably, I don't know if it's zero, it should be 25% random sequences. And so we're just looking, I think, across windows of maybe 100 bases or 50 bases at sequence conservation. And this is melanogaster versus yacuba. This is melanogaster versus erecta. Here's pseudobscura, so we're looking at increasingly distant comparisons. And I would say, you know, if it's sort of hide the enhancer, if I asked you, if I didn't have these highlighted in blue to predict where the enhancers were, it's not obvious, and go out to pseudo-obscura. And here's the stripe 2 enhancer. It's just kind of, you know, not obvious. And to a large extent, it's because of all the changes that have occurred in the spacers, in the regions between those modules, the insertions and deletions. The sequences really just go off. And the amount that's conserved is not that great. Yeah. Okay. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, 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 yeah. It does. Yeah, it's an alignment, pairwise alignment. Oh no, it's not. No, there's a kind of optimized local alignment all through. It's a global. There's no inversions. And I'm not going to make a lot of it, but I want to say, I just show you, for those of you who haven't looked at these things, I mean, we're talking about this sort of canonical developmental gene with these beautifully evolved cis regulatory modules. But the spacing, the sequences between binding sites, and I'm going to show you in a minute even the binding site, they evolve a lot. And depending on how you look for them, it's not actually so easy to detect. They undergo a lot of evolutionary change, and that's really the only point. But just as Eric showed, these are these kind of dot plot comparisons. Here is the Eve, same region. Here's the start of transcription, stripe 2, stripe 3.7, comparing pseudo-obscura against melanogaster. If you filter the data just right, we did a lot of filtering, that is to say, you kind of tune all the parameters in doing these comparisons to reduce sort of the noise and bring out the signal. You do pick out these little conserved bits all along. So no, actually not exactly the same one, because the one I showed you, those were based on various kind of global alignment programs, and then just a lot of work on our own part trying to see if we can improve on the alignments. And as everyone knows, you can. There's nothing magical about those alignment algorithms, because they're entirely stupid with respect to how they deal with insertions and deletions. They simply have a set of rules for gap opening penalties, gap extension penalties, gap closing penalties, and they're just made up out of thin air. We really don't know. So they don't produce correct alignment The only thing they produce is they produce reproducible ones. If you do it again on the same sequence and parameter, you get the same result. But so we, you know, if I showed you those outputs and what we have, it would be quite obvious. And especially because those alignments sometimes don't put binding sites together. And we say, you know, well, you know, that Bicoite site should be there. And it is there, but it moved it over. And when you push it over, there it is. And so our alignments were also guided by some knowledge of functional. But my point is, you know, if you work hard, you can see it. This is a really beautiful example. This is decapentaplegic, very important regulatory gene, 37 to 43,000 base pairs downstream from the gene in Drosophila. Drosophila doesn't have that many genes where the intergenic spacing is as large as this. So this is expressed DPP in many, many different times and places in development. And as a hell of a lot of enhancement, you can see they just line up like ducks in a row. These citations point out that these people actually showed that these are functional cis-regulatory modules. I collaborated with someone and we showed that this one was as well. But basically, you know, there's an unusual gene with big intergenic region, and it is just packed about as close as you can imagine packing these things with all these functional cis-regulatory modules, and there they are. So in a way, that makes Drosophila nice. Compact genome, not a lot of inversions, rearrangements to that interfere with this. So just to go back to these binding sites, it turns out, if you actually look at the sequences, the binding sites are not conserved either, or they are conserved only to a degree. So this just is an alignment of all of these binding sites. Now, these are the binding sites that are known for melanogaster, and we're looking at corresponding sequences in these other species. And as you can see, not all but most of these binding sites have mutated in one or more of the species. In some cases, not very dramatically. I don't know, well, here there's a hunchback 3 site where actually melanogaster is missing a base, these species, compared to pseudo-obscura. It's inserted one base, but otherwise it's the same. A couple of changes at the margin of this hunchback site. The hunchback 1 site actually is present in melanogaster. It's slightly different in these other species. There's a mutation from this T to C, and Steve said, you know, sort of a run of T's is a hunchback site. So this has a C in these other closely related species. In these other species, it's not present at all. There's just no run of T's at all. The same is true for this site, the Bicoid 3 site. It's present, and it has that nice T-A-A-T-C, pretty good binding site, although Steve said it's somewhat of a weak site compared to the couple of the other ones, but it's canonically not a bad site. And they knocked this one out and showed that it is required at some level. You know, it had a phenotype, so presumably functional. They did not get robust expression of that minimal stripe enhancement when they knocked this Bicoid 3 site. Well, it's present in melanogaster. It's just not present anywhere else. So this is a recent innovation in the lineage leading to melanogaster, where it evolved a new Bicoid 3 binding site, which is apparently somewhat functional. So, well, you picked a bad example because there is no weight matrix for giant 3. No one's been able to figure out at all what the sequence specificity is. But for Bicoid, the answer is invariably yes. They're still binding sites. They fall well within, you know, the matrix of reasonable possibility. Don't know. I'm going to show you a lot of functional data, and maybe we can infer something from the functional analysis. But as I've said, perhaps we're really stupid about this, because we've been doing this for a while. We've known about this for a long time, and for example, especially this, they showed that this site is important. Well, you know, you say, well, do the experiment, and you know, knock this out or substitute between the species and see whether it really is functionally evolved. And we've been very reluctant to do that, just because, again, even if you compare melanogaster with simulans or yacuba, they differ at a number of sites. And the game is this. The ones with the most dramatic differences are the more distantly related species. But the more distantly related species have so many changes in them that you don't know which ones to really go after. And if there's any kind of epistatic interactions between them, then you could spend your lifetime chasing things. And I was reluctant to do it. And in fact, I had a colleague who did this to try to analyze the molecular basis of expression level differences for alcohol dehydrogenase, a gene that I spent the first part of my career working on. There's a beautiful protein polymorphism in Drosophila melanogaster. There is about a twofold expression level difference of the protein. And my colleague, Kathy Lurie, it seemed like there were some obvious candidates. And she spent years doing the transgenes and eventually could explain part of it. But it, again, it did involve epistatic interaction. There's a mutation in an intron, a synonymous change. It's very hard to... And that kind of made me reluctant to start doing this at this point. We have enough knowledge that now we're doing it. But with more powerful tools. And the other thing that we're reluctant to do is that the LACZ transgene assay that Steve showed you, it's terrific for seeing the phenotype. It's not so terrific for kind of measuring it quantitatively. And so we were always worried about, there's always an issue of, these are evolved differences in a very, very functionally conserved gene. The actual functional differences may be very, very small. Do we have the tools or techniques and the sensitivity to be able to measure those differences? So we've been quite cautious, starting with more distantly related species, where if there's some functional evolution, we maybe thought we'd have a better chance of seeing it, or the change might be larger. And we've been working our way in towards more closely related species where the differences are fewer, and also refining our experimental techniques so that we can see things more clearly. You mean that BCOID 3 site?
Yeah.
No. If you look at the analysis of the sequence, it looks like it just, through random mutations, changed. And yeah. So not an insertion, or it didn't come from anywhere. It just involved several mutations. And my guess, actually, because there are several changes in that occurred relatively quickly in evolution, aided by adaptation. Once it became a weak BCOID site, then they may have favored some additional mutations to kind of pull it in. I sometimes refer to that as accretion. Selection kind of sucked it in to become a functional site. This just shows some more distant, more species, a more distantly related relationship. And here's Drosophila virilis. And you can see, by the time you get to virilis, there's changes, a lot of changes going on in almost all of these binding sites. Okay, and I have no idea why these talking points are so slow in coming up. I've never had this problem on this computer before. I don't know. Fortunately, I only have one or two of these in the rest of the slides, so as soon as it brings up perhaps point three, I'll move on. We're getting there. Okay, so again, Steve probably didn't show you this, but here's how we did a lot of our early experiments. This is this LACZ reporter gene. Here's LACZ. It's fused at codon number 22 to even skip. It has the even skip proximal promoter intact. And then at position minus 42, we built a site that allowed us to pop in an Eve stripe 2 cassette. And that Eve stripe 2 cassette might be the sequence from Yacuba, or from Pseudo-Obscura, or from one of the other species, into this reporter gene. Spacer, and then Eve stripe 3 plus 7 as well. So this is a dual reporter, that is to say, it's going to drive expression, hopefully, of stripes 3 plus 7 and stripe 2. We never screw around with this, so in some ways it's just a control, a positive control for position effect and various other things. And it turns out it's convenient because you can actually compare stripe 2 expression to stripe 3, 7, wherein everything you do, this is always the same. So it provides a convenient internal control. But that's what these things look like. And to be certain, we got this thing from Steve. So again, just to show you what happens, Cole, you had a picture of this, but it just kind of gives you a temporal progression of how Eve stripe formed. And so this is a fly line in which we've inserted that transgene with the LACZ, and it's stained both for LACZ in purple and native Eve stripes in brown. And so you can see Eve and Skip is initially expressed kind of in a broad domain, and then it's kind of slowly kind of coalesces into these stripes. And as Steve was saying, that you know the thought is that the stripes are really formed and sharpened by repression domains. And so you kind of see that happening, that what's happening is Eve expression is sharpening where the stripes are, but it's clearing out in the interstripe region. And here is kind of where you have a nice, somewhere in here is a fully cellularized blastoderm embryo, or a mid-cellularized blastoderm embryo. And that's where we do a lot of our comparisons. And you could see at this point, these stripes 2, 3, and 7, not so concerned about 7, but stripes 2 and 3, I'll show you more pictures, coincide very nicely with the native stripes. But actually, as the embryo enters gastrulation, you can see these stripes move apart. So the reporter no longer reflects what's happening in the native Eve. And I don't exactly know what the explanation is, but what happens is that expression, once the embryo is fully cellularized, expression is taken over by this late element, or at least that's the thought. And cells are moving. I mean, because you get this germ band extension, things are moving, dividing, and the stripes kind of go with those cells as they move. But the LACZ reporter just kind of lags. So I don't want to talk about it because I know nothing more than what I just said. But But at this point, you know, at the cells, there's a beautiful coincidence of stripes. I thought you might like to see that. Yeah. So here's some of those experiments where we, this is putting in a melanogaster stripe 2 element, okay? Yacuba stripe 2 element, Erecta stripe 2 element, pseudo-obscura stripe 2 element, driving LACZ, looking at these kind of mid-cellular embryos where there's nice coincidence. And actually what we do, the fact that we have these, it's actually convenient that the LACZ stripes are moving in the sense that what we do is we search for embryos in which the stripe 3 LACZ is superimposed on the native stripe 3. And we look in those embryos at where stripe 2 is. So we kind of know we've pegged all of these to be at the same developmental time point, at least based on stripe 3. And you can see the coincidence is beautiful. Here's the positive control. This is the melanogaster stripe 2 element compared to stripe 3. You know, kind of fuzzy picture, more detailed picture. It's really remarkable, as I say, this small piece of DNA has this amazing specificity. But you see Yacuba, Erecta, pseudo-obscura, they're just dead in the same place. Find absolutely no evidence that there's shift in where these stripes are formed relative to the native stripes. Really quite dramatic. What we do see, although something is hard to quantitate with this kind of black staining, is that these are stripe 2s in these other here, the melanogaster, stripe 2 and 3, 7, sometimes it's easy to see it here, have about equal intensity. But they're notably weaker than the other species. And almost all the species we've transformed into melanogaster, the stripe 2 elements are weaker than the melanogaster. These eggs are pretty much the same size, although I can't swear that these are retouched in some, or, you know, rescaled. But pseudopsira actually produce a pretty small egg, so it may actually be a little bit smaller. There's not a big difference in those species. I'm going to show you ones where there's big differences, but they're roughly the same size. Yeah, so let me, I think it's just coming up right now. And those are all melanogaster embryos. Oh, I'm sorry, those are all melanogaster embryos. Sorry, sorry about that. Yes. Yeah, sorry about that. I completely s***ed out. So these are all, these are all Drosophila melanogaster. All the work we're doing now is with these other species, and I completely incorrectly answered your question. But these are all, of course, melanogaster embryos. They just have transgenes driving these reporters, okay? You asked whether we flip promoters. Here's a promoter flip experiment. So this is, again, these are Drosophila melanogaster embryos. Melanogaster 3 plus 7 element, melanogaster stripe 2 element, melanogaster core promoter. Melanogaster stripe 3 plus 7, melanogaster stripe 2 element, virulous core promoter. So we took a distantly related species, okay? Use the virulous core promoter. Here's the two embryos, okay? Core promoter, as far as we can tell, just doesn't matter. We haven't attempted to quantify this. There may be some subtle difference, but it's very clear that that core promoter doesn't matter. Here's melanogaster 3 plus 7. We always use melanogaster 3 plus 7. We don't play with that. Here's the virulous stripe 2 element. Virulous stripe 2 element with its own core promoter or with the melanogaster core promoter. But this is in melanogaster, and it's weak. It's weak, okay? So the stripe 2 element of virulus is weak in melanogaster, and it doesn't depend on any specific interaction with the promoter. Let me hold off because we haven't looked at the actual dynamics so much, but we have so many more experiments that at least partially address that question. I'll talk about it in a little while. You'll see we've at least partially addressed that issue. So here's the next experiment. This is great. It took us a long time to do. See, those are not melanogaster embryos. Those are Drosophila virulus embryos. We were able to do the reciprocal experiment. We put the exact same constructs into Drosophila virulus to see what happens. Okay? So now we're looking at the virulus environment and gradient environment and see what happens. And here's kind of, and again, the core promoter, these are comparing the two different core promoters, don't matter. So it doesn't matter in this species either. Core promoter doesn't seem to matter. Stripe 2 element from melanogaster produces a nice robust stripe. So whereas the virulus produces a weak stripe in melanogaster, the melanogaster stripe 2 element is nice and strong. Okay? So there isn't that kind of reciprocity. But if you look at the, in either of these two, here's the virulus stripe 2 element, or the virulous stripe 2 element, you can see it's pretty robust in virulus compared to what it is in melanogaster. So the virulous stripe 2 element we're working produces a robust stripe in its own species, independent of the core promoter, but not in melanogaster. So there's perhaps something about the the activating environment in melanogaster that is different from this, such that so perhaps, for example, there's a stronger activating environment in Virilis, and it's evolved a slightly weaker enhancer for activation signals. Or conversely, for example, where we see that new evolution of a bicoid site in melanogaster, the melanogaster has a weaker activating environment, and the enhancer has actually evolved some additional binding sites to compensate. So perhaps this compensatory evolution. We haven't tested that, but it's certainly consistent with these kind of results, and we wanted to get this experimental result before we went on. Before we tried to screw around with that bicoid site to look more carefully at whether that's possible, we wanted to get this reciprocal experiment done. And it turned out you have to use a different vector because the P element-derived vector that is used in all the melanogaster experiments doesn't work in these other species. And we got piggyback to work in some species, but not others. And we spent quite a bit of time doing it, but this was a nice experiment. And I think this is probably one of the first times anyone looked at these data. Well, this kind of picture is, you know, spending days searching for the typical embryo to put up on a slide. But we've looked at a lot, and we haven't quantitated. And in truth, these experiments were simply part of kind of a set of control experiments just to get the piggyback working. And so in some ways, it's not a perfect experiment, and we didn't really intend to quantify with this. One of the problems is that all of them have the melanogaster stripe 3+7. So comparing these against the melanogaster, it looks like the 3+7 element is kind of robust everywhere. And but we don't really know that. You stain these for different amounts of time. So this isn't really a perfect experiment. Well, we have both. These two have the melanogaster core promoter. These two have the Virilis core promoter in Virilis. But people have not actually done these kind of experiments, you know, that I'm showing, actually trying to do core promoter swaps to look at that interaction this way. So, we've always sort of walked this fine line. We're interested in evolutionary questions. The experiments are hard enough, and I don't pretend to be a molecular geneticist on the level of Steve. So, you know, we get these results, and they really, you know, you want to dive into more mechanistic questions, but we, you know, they're quite highly conserved, actually. And if I went back, but I don't want to go past the talking point slide again. Actually, the stripe 2 element is about, you know, 1,000 bases, 900 bases upstream. And the sequences in all these species remains quite conserved. And when you get into the closer core promoter region, they're quite highly conserved. So maybe it's not surprising. But it was an experiment that, you know, always came up. You're driving these enhancers with the melanogaster core promoter. Does that matter? Is there an interaction? So we needed to do this experiment. But they are highly conserved, and it's consistent with that. So I'll tell you about an kind of notorious experiment we did in which we made a swap. We took a conserved block right in the middle of the enhancer that turned out to be the sloppy pair, perfectly conserved site. And we made these chimeras in which half of the enhancer was from pseudo-obscura, half from melanogaster, and the other one So here's, again, melanogaster, strike 2 element in melanogaster, pseudo-obscura, strike 2 enhancer in melanogaster, and here are the two chimeras, and most notably, you can see here, this chimera doesn't function correctly. The LAC-Z expression is now much broader and displaced into the interstripe region between stripe 2 and 3. This one also, if you look at it carefully, it's not so obvious here, also has a broader zone of expression and isn't expressing perfectly. But it's very obvious in this chimer. So, interesting. The stripes, there may be differences in expression levels. When you look at these native stripes, they are just smack on where they should be. But it obviously involves compensatory or co-evolved changes in the 5' and 3' halves of these molecules that are required to be together in order to preserve that positional identity. So this is a first indication that there really are functionally evolved differences in these perhaps binding sites, or it could be the spacers, I don't know. And that there's been some evolutionary compensation to maintain these things. So actually the way we think about this is that it really is just like a trait under stabilizing selection. Human birth weight, the classic example. It's not that good if you have a 14-pound baby, and mortality rate is much, much higher, similarly if it's 2 pounds. So there's strong stabilizing selection for intermediate birth weight. And same as here. The phenotype of this enhancer is simply to produce a stripe in the right place. And there are mutations, and Steve's work making mutations showed it beautifully. If you, you know, reduce a cripple site, you can get posterior expansion, anterior expansion, expansion of the stripe. You can get the stripes to shift. And those mutations apparently do occur and have fixed. But stabilizing selection perhaps just keeps this thing, roughly speaking, right where it's supposed to be. And there may be some subtle evolved differences that shifted one way and some compensatory mutations that pull it back and keep it in these same places. But the changes are not entirely functionless. They obviously have some functional consequence, and they have to be in the right combination of evolved differences to maintain this. Well, you know, the sloppy pair binding site was not known, but conveniently, right in the middle of this enhancer was a completely conserved piece of DNA. So we simply made the swap right in the middle of the conserved piece of DNA, so we didn't change the sequence because of the swap. Right, not depend on the alignment or anything like that. So that turned out to be convenient. The fly? Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, these are sequenced, and, you know, we made these chimeras, and they're, you know, what we say they are. And all of these analyses, Misha's really very careful. These involve making many independent transgenic flies and not depending on one for these results. So I'll tell you about work we've done more recently, which tries to improve the whole approach. And that is, instead of using sort of this reporter gene, it would be nice if we could actually just change the native stripe 2 element itself and see what effect there is on the embryo. Because the phenotype of the LAC-Z reporter is just LAC-Z, and it really doesn't affect the embryo at all. They'll develop, they're fine, they make flies. On the other hand, like with that chimer with pseudo-obscura, right? It'd be interesting to know whether that fly could survive or not when the stripe gets shifted. And perhaps we thought that if one could do it that way, we might be able to develop more sensitive assays to look for subtle evolved differences. We did it indirectly. We also do it directly now. But when we started this 4 or 5 years ago, site-directed replacement for mutagenesis had just been published, and no one had done it yet, and we were reluctant to try it at that point. Now it's possible. You can simply, by site-directed changes, we do that now. make a change in the native gene itself. But we did it in a more roundabout way. As Steve said, the whole gene is about 16 kb. We took a 15 kb piece given to us by Miki Fujioka, and we just took out the stripe 2 enhancer. Okay? So now this is not in the fly. This is just on a plasmid something. Okay? We got 15 kb piece of DNA on a plasmid. We took out the stripe 2 enhancer, and then we put this back into the fly as a transgene. Okay? So it's the whole Eve locus, just missing a stripe 2 element. And then we selected flies for ones in which it landed on the same chromosome, the second chromosome, as the native Eve locus. And then we crossed it to null mutations. So the native Eve locus is dead. There's a couple of different null mutations. One of them is a deletion that actually deletes the whole locus. Another is an amino acid change that produces a mutation that produces a premature termination. And both of them are considered good null alleles, and we've done the experiments with both of these kind of backgrounds. It doesn't matter. So it no longer has a native Eve locus. We put in an Eve locus, the whole Eve locus, in all its glory, but missing a stripe 2 element. Now, actually, as it turns out, this is a 15 kb piece of DNA. And you do get what Fujioka showed is, if you take this thing, the whole piece, this one, and put it back in the fly and do that experiment, put it into this R13, the fly survives. You get adult survival. So it can complement this mutation. It has everything it needs to make a fly, but not quite at the same rate as wild type. So it's not clean. She subsequently showed, but we didn't use, that if you use a 16 kb piece of DNA, apparently there's some things right at the margins here that actually so are required to get kind of the complete Eve locus. Those actually transform and produce higher viability in adults. Not perfect viability, but you get viable adults. So now we have a fly that, you know, makes everything but a stripe 2 element, and there's the fly, right? Except that it makes a little bit of a stripe 2 element, and no one has a clue, I think, what's going on there. And don't ask me questions, because I don't want to waste any time talking about it. But we could talk about it later. Steve might be more interested. There is a discernible weak fly, and we do know a few things about it. But to a first approximation, it doesn't make a stripe 2, as one would predict. And if you look, I'll show you better pictures later. Here's engrailed expression. Eve stripe 4 is that engrailed stripe 4, so this is a segment polarity gene, is known to require Eve stripe 2 expression to turn it on. You normally get these 14 nice, evenly spaced, robust stripes, and this is what's left of stripe 4. So don't make an Eve stripe 2. It doesn't produce an engrailed stripe 4 later in development. And this is obviously going to be lethal. This embryo won't hatch. It's going to be missing a whole segment of the embryo. It's lethal, as one would expect. Okay? So then the obvious experiment is to see whether we can complement the loss of this stripe 2 element by putting in stripe 2 elements, and they're going to be from, again, different species. Let's see how the different species perform. But not driving LACZ now. That's worthless. We're going to have it drive Eve itself. Okay? And we hook this up and leave all the spacing intact and everything, so we're not messing at all. It's just exactly where it should be relative to the native Eve. And we're going to put this in the fly. It'll make a stripe 2, hopefully. We'll cross these together and we'll see whether it can rescue. Okay. Here are the different constructs we made. This actually shows you the difference in the size of those elements to give some idea of kind of expansion and contraction of those spacing between binding sites. Pseudo-obscura, straight to them, and between these, there's these conserved sequences at the boundaries. But in between, they kind of expanding by about that much. These are kind of drawn to scale. And we also had a negative control. We popped. It's quite highly conserved between all the species, yes. And in this case, it's all identical. And the same as native. So here are those constructs put in the fly. And so now we're staining not for LAC-Z, we're actually staining for EVE, anti-EVE. And you can see they make something akin to a stripe too, although you can see this is actually stained for a long time to get kind of a weak stripe. And we have many, many independent transformants of this. We've checked the sequences in the fly. Everything is fine. It makes a weak stripe. So the stripe intensities are not necessarily the same, but they make stripe. We cross this into an EVE deletion line, so it doesn't make any native EVE. That's why. So we use some genetics to remove all the native EVE stripes, so you could just see this one. Yeah, that's a good point. So now we're going to do the experiment. We'll try to cross these things and see a combination. And actually, it took a lot of work. What we did is, when you put in these P elements, they land anywhere in the genome. So there's ostensibly 5 chromosome arms, X, 2L, 2R, 3L, 3R. And they land in all 5 of those arms about at equal frequency. But we selected ones that landed on chromosome 3. This EVE locus is on chromosome 2. We did it for a reason, as you can see. Because what we actually did is, in doing these analyses, this is kind of the setup we used. And maybe I'm going into too much detail here, but just goes to show, you can use some genetics. I mean, there's all these beautiful tools. This is the construct we made that now is driving EVE from here, but it doesn't have a stripe too. And it's over a balancer chromosome. This curly O is a balancer chromosome. This can't recombine. These two chromosomes can't recombine. This is multiply inverted. And it has a native EVE locus. EVE's not knocked out on that locus. So a fly that has this genotype has one good copy of the complete EVE locus, and it survives. Okay. And similarly, the rescue transgene, I call this the rescue transgene on chromosome 3, is maintained over a balancer like that. And the cross, the analysis, so what we want to do now, I'll show you pictures of, I showed you pictures of what the EVE stripe 2 by itself looks like on these species. But we're actually going to measure survivorship. We're going to see whether they complement and rescue the lethality of eliminating the stripe 2 by doing this kind of cross. It's a classic cross invented by Muller and Dobzhansky, where you use these two different balancers. And what we did is, since we have multiple independent transformants of the rescue transgene on different places in the third chromosome, we did the analysis, the most informative analysis is crossing two different ones of these rescue transgene lines. So these have hopped in different places. As to illustrate, I show this is sort of on the left side of this chromosome. This is on the right side of the chromosome. It's the same transgene, but they're in different places. And the reason is that sometimes where the transgene lands might interfere with native gene functions in that region and reduce viability. And we don't want to measure viability simply caused by that kind of position effect. Usually, it's almost entirely recessive. That's well known. When you do have two copies in the same place, sometimes you get, flies are lethal, sometimes semi-lethal, sometimes no effect at all. But when you do it cross this way to make these kind of flies, like down here, this is the genotype that has no good stripe 2 being produced here. It's all being supplied here in two copies, two doses on both cones, but they're different locations. And the fact that these viability effects tend to be recessive hopefully masks that. I'll show you what it does beautifully. But we can compare when there's only one copy rescuing or two copies rescuing, and these in some ways act as controls, and you have these expected ratios. Well, here's the EVE gene. We put the EVE gene, it just lacks the stripe 2 enhancer. So these have two copies of, first of all, the native locus is, that's the native EVE locus. It's knocked out. It has this R13 mutation in it, and it's not functional. This is now the functional Eve locus, but it's delta stripe 2E. It's missing its stripe 2 element. Stripe 2 is going to be supplied here, either in one copy or two copies. So you can look at him. So I'm going to measure rescue. I can show you. So kind of here's the typical experiment. These are the number of flies surviving to adulthood in these different, the four different genotypic classes, which you expect in a 4:2 to 2:1 ratio, ideally. This ratio here, this is just one of those rescue transgene by itself, so that these are, and this is the other rescue transgene by itself, and these are making those trans kind of heterozygote copies. But the point is, if you look here, so these two right here, okay, they have a curly chromosome. Both these have a curly chromosome. So they don't need the rescue transgene to survive. They have one good functional copy of a complete Eve locus, okay? But they have either one copy or two copies of the either TM3 over TM3 or normal over normal. You expect a 2:1 ratio here, and you obviously 1700 to 592. When you have two copies of the rescue transgene, this one, obviously there's some fitness effect just of where it landed. It's not being used to rescue, it's just, it has an effect. But this one, 1079, 517, there's nice too. This landed in a different place in the genome. Two copies, it produces perfectly normal ratios, okay? Here are the transzygotes, and here you can see there's nice 2:1 ratio. And these are the survivors. So I just, you're going to deal with the numbers. Here are the results of that experiment. First of all, the negative control, we never got any surviving flies. Here's the melanogaster positive control. So this is the melanogaster strike 2 element rescuing loss of melanogaster strike 2 element in one copy and two copy. And this is relative rescue percent. So there's actually a little bit of a difference between one copy and two copies. So there's a little bit of what's called haploinsufficiency here, a measurable amount, actually. But it actually it rescues quite nicely. That haploinsufficiency was already known for the whole locus. Here we show there's actually some, even just that single strike 2 element. Yeah, relative to what we expect. That's right. So I should say that in this, I want to go back. These relative rescue percentages. So this is actually interesting and important to say. So in this case, we've knocked out the strike 2 element. We've put it in as a transgene on another chromosome driving Eve, and these are the rescue percentages we get. Now, Fujioka actually took that whole 15 kb piece of DNA with everything intact, put it in the fly in the same M13, R13 background, and she got virtually identical, within a percentage point, rescue percentages. So actually, rescuing that loss of strike 2 element in trans, the way we did it, works perfectly. The whole 15 kb piece, unmodified, gives virtually identical rescue percentages. So they're not perfect. As I said, Fujioka then later did it with this 16 kb piece, and they went up some. But still, it looks pretty good. So here's the result, quite interesting. Here's pseudo-obscura. It's the most distantly related. Here's the phylogeny, okay? The rescue percentage, one copy and two copies, are identical to melanogaster. Not just kind of statistically indistinguishable, but virtually identical, actually. Well, we measured a lot of flies. This is... Eve.
And you were just saying 25% doesn't have anything to do with striking on another chromosome.
That's right. It gives exactly the same as if you, we hadn't knocked out stripe 2. We just left it right on that 15 Gaby piece to get the same rhythm. So actually, that's kind of neat. And we were obviously gratified. Here's Yakuba, Erecta. Notably, the Erecta, we could never get it to rescue. We analyzed at least four independent transformants of this rescue transgene. It never could rescue that inviability. These are, we just essentially almost never got any flies, adult flies hatching out. That simply, you can see a stripe, and it's making it in the right place. But I'll show you, we know why it's doing this, but it doesn't, biologically, it's not working. That's the beauty of this. I mean, you're really looking at the biological function now, not just a reporter. Here's Yakuba. It too, one copy doesn't rescue very well compared to two copies. There's about a threefold reduction relative to these in how well one copy versus two copy works. Although we did get very robust for whatever reason with two copies. But one copy doesn't work that well, and I'll show you a little bit about why that is as well. So it's quite interesting. Here's the positive control. I'll show you the negative control work right. We look at three different species. We get three different patterns. So in some ways, it's the best result you could want. There's everything you can imagine there. But interestingly, the most distantly related species with the most sequence change and all those spacing differences, it was that large one. It just rescues absolutely perfectly. And but the closely related species don't. So engrailed analysis, quite informative. This is a so what we've done is, I showed you the embryo that was folded around. Well, you can unfold them, and you can look at all the 14 engrailed stripes in all their glory. This is a positive, this is the negative control. This is just a fly that is missing a stripe 2 element, and we've knocked out the native locus. So this is the fly that has no stripe 2. And here is that kind of puny vestige of stripe 4. Here's a positive control, beautifully evenly spaced engrailed stripes. Here's Drosophila erecta with two copies. It's just like this one, okay? You pointed out, well, look, you show me it makes a stripe. It makes a stripe, but it's not enough to drive engrailed expression, apparently. Okay, and that's pretty clear from this analysis. And that's kind of the neat thing about doing the experiment this way, as opposed to with reporting. You're not only looking at kind of the biology, you can look at the developmental consequences of these differences. And so here, on the other hand, is melanogaster, Yakuba two copies, pseudo-obscura two copies, and positive control. They all make kind of beautiful engrailed stripes in the right place, okay? And all of these rescued quite nicely. So, and they obviously rescue flies to adulthood, and developmentally they look perfectly normal as far as we can tell. What I wanted to show you is quite interesting. Here's the Yakuba one copy compared to the Yakuba two copy. And one copy embryos, which rescued but rather weakly, we didn't get that many adult flies out. You can see that it has an engrailed phenotype. It's a weaker stripe. It always looks like it's pushed a little anteriorly. That's all I can say. This embryo we killed to do this, so we can't tell you whether this particular embryo would have survived to adulthood. And so perhaps the embryos that are surviving to adulthood, for whatever developmental reason, kind of get their stripe a little bit better, and they're the ones that are surviving. But many of the embryos of these one-copy genotypes kind of produce this, have this engrailed phenotype. So it looks like there's a, there is a developmental correlate with the inability to rescue. Well, as I say, all we really know, it's not so much chromosomal interactions, but all I can say here is that You know, we know in this hierarchy of pair-role genes turning on segment polarity genes, and because we know that at least Eve stripe 2 is required for activation of engrailed stripe 4, we're just looking at one of the functions of Eve stripe 2 in pushing development forward and getting a segment polarity gene expressed at the right place in the right time. So that's really all it's saying, is that, you know, all the ones that survived well make that transition in development. The one, the erector that couldn't survive, didn't make that transition. And that really kind of localizes the causation to that small window of developmental time. That it really is the fact that, that there's something wrong with that Eve stripe 2 that's causing, you know, a progression of abnormal development. I'm gonna see if I can kind of get past these. I have about maybe, do I have about 30 minutes if it's a quarter of, till a quarter after or so, or 15, 20, 25 minutes? One thing I want to show. We did quantify expression. We actually quantified it, you know, with using fluorescent probes. And the way we could do it conveniently is because is to compare expression of these transgene stripes to stripe 3. We use an adjacent stripe. And since stripe 3 is always made exactly the same way by the same kind of gene from the native locus, we could compare and look at relative intensities. And this just shows pseudo-obscure 0, 1, 2 doses of the transgene. You get this nice increase in expression level. And here is the erecta transgene, 0, 1, 2 copies of the transgene. I showed you the picture. It makes a weak Eve stripe 2, but it's almost not measurable. Bye. You're saying big. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. One imagines that there are some defects later in development. Eve not only drives the pair-role stripes, but then it has about, how many more? 10, another 10 or 8 or 7, 5, 6 enhancers that are responsible for expression later in development. They have the same genotype, yeah. So they don't rescue completely all of them, but presumably there's some defect later. It doesn't really have to do with, all those stripe elements are nicely contained within this piece, but something else, yeah. So the reason that erect is not working is that it really isn't driving expression. Oh, no. Two genes. With everything else. We could have. Yeah, you know, it's really just a technical limitation, but, you know, in many ways, the whole experiment is working as if we just removed the stripe 2 element and put a stripe 2 element back from these different species. Okay? But there's kind of nothing in the experiment that's suggesting. Otherwise. So let me just say that so again, you know, erecta, it makes a stripe in the right place, the enhancer, but obviously the trans environments must be different because it That erect enhancer makes a nice robust stripe in Drosophila recta. It doesn't make a good stripe when you put it in melanogaster. When you put it against the reporter, you can see it makes a stripe in the right place. It's quite weak. We see it's weak. It's not enough activated. So there's some functionally evolved difference between the two. Again, suggesting that maybe there's some difference in kind of the activation environment. And this is an indirect lead-in to the next set of experiments that I really want to get to and tell you a little bit about. But this is something that Steve talked about again and again and again. This is, again, adopted from Lawrence. I think this was in his book, looking at the famous experiment where you can load up on extra copies of Bicoid, so the gradient in Bicoid gets pushed further and further back in the embryo, and then look at parallel stripes, but, and you can see the parallel stripes just get pushed further and further back. So the fact that it seemed like that these enhancers can activate in their own species, but not necessarily in melanogaster, suggests that maybe the strength of these gradients are or the activation environment, but it could actually be just the Bicoid protein sequences are different between the species. And it just let us get interested in, do these flies actually, they all make seven stripes. Do they make them in the same place in the embryo? Or are they kind of pushed back or pushed forward? And that might be another indication of different the background environment. And actually, it's pretty clear. This is an erecta embryo. Here's the melanogaster embryo. It kind of has a bigger head region than melanogaster. And we actually have never done a formal quantitative analysis of this, but in sort of the measured, this is actually measured unconventionally from the back of the embryo, but it doesn't matter, one minus this or is from the anterior, but that the stripes are pushed back somewhat in erecta compared to melanogaster. And that led us into the subject I want to tell you about now, which we have some, I think, kind of fascinating results. We got interested in egg size for basically this reason. The erecta and melanogaster eggs are not so different in size, but we got interested in this whole question, and it was motivated by some things that Steve was talking about, a study by Vishaus and colleagues, asking about the robustness of stripe positioning, as Steve talked about it. But egg size creates an interesting challenge to setting up where the stripes are, because I don't know, these are a whole bunch of different species, but if you look at male and sim and Seychelles, things like that, development times are about the same. They just divide like crazy, you know, produce cellular blast germ, pretty much the same amount of time. A certain amount of time for diffusion of Bicoid. Bicoid sets up the positioning system for the expression of the stripes. And so if you have a bigger embryo, the stripes are going to be, relatively speaking, more anterior. So how do they compensate? This is a question, do they compensate? Okay. Now, there's actually been a little bit of work on this by and Eric, as well as some others, have published on this, where they were able to, without really necessarily trying, if you just take a lab strain, Argon R, they produce embryos that are somewhat different size, just due to some stochastic noise in development. Now, in some ways, you can actually try to stunt the fly to produce tiny eggs. You haven't really analyzed those. But so they did, there is some analysis of just environmentally induced size variation within a strain, so there's no genetic variation in the system. These are isogenic strains, but just embryo-to-embryo noise. And they put their stripes in the right place relative to the length of the embryo. So at least in that sense, they seem to have solved the scaling problem. But we thought this is really an interesting evolutionary problem. And we can look at genetic differences in egg size and see how robust the scaling is to genetic differences in egg size. These are melanogaster stocks. We just, you know, we have a bunch of stocks from different places around the world. We just screened a bunch, and you can see there's tremendous variation in egg size. And these are genetically reproducible. This is a stock called India. It's from an isogenic line originating in India. It produces a whopping big egg, and it always produces a whopping big egg. This is a line from France that produces an egg relatively on the small end of the distribution scale. Now, something is known about this. This is polymorphism within a species. It's adaptive. It's very well known. There is genetic variation for egg size. It is strongly clinal with latitude. Larger eggs are produced in northern latitudes, and also altitudinally colder regions. As you go up altitudes, eggs get bigger repeatedly on all the continents. It's a very good pattern, not just in Melanogaster, but in especially all the species that have been investigated. And in fact, just like Haldane's rule and Cope's rule, and someone's name associated with this rule, in insects in general, there are egg size varies with latitude in the same way. Larger eggs, higher latitudes. So someone did an experiment where they just collected a population of flies from one population. There's some genetic variation for egg size segregation. You just divide the population in half, so they have two laboratory populations, and grow some for a couple of years in an 18 or 17 degree incubator, 16 I think they did, and one at 25, they evolve egg size differences just on their own. You're not actually artificially selecting for it. You can artificially select. There's genetic variation. Select for the biggest egg, you get a nice response to selection. But even just, there's natural selection, just growing them at a colder temperature, they will evolve larger size on their own. So exactly why bigger size is adaptive, I don't know, but it's fairly universal. And that's why there's a lot of variation in egg size. So there is a scaling problem that flies need to solve. No. Like in these lines here, India, these Cantonese, these are highly inbred lines. They're not segregating for any genetic variation. And so, their egg size are quite stable. But if you start with a population collection where there's a lot of genetic variability, then the selection will take off. So that's basically the answer. And there's differences between species in egg size. This is a really interesting one. Seychellia produce a whopping big egg. Really big, almost as big as you can find. The adult size is the same as Melanogaster. Again, it's like simulants. It's indistinguishable. You can't. If I showed you the two, you could not tell me which was Melanogaster and which was Seychellia, except if you're an expert and you can look at a certain genital arch in the males. You can tell the males apart. But they same size. They produce much bigger eggs and many fewer of them. Okay? So this is a life history trade-off, presumably, of some sort. They make many fewer, larger eggs. And as I say, because Drosophila seychellii is only found on the Seychelles Islands, and because of these bottleneck effects, there's not a lot of genetic variability, if virtually any, in the species. Of all the stocks we've looked at produce this big egg. And there's no latitudinal clines in Seychelles. So they produce one big egg. Simulans produces a range. We haven't investigated it extensively. But so I'm going to tell you about an analysis we did looking at how stripes are positioned in this line here, so small and large within Melanogaster, small and large between Simulans and Seychellia. And actually, these egg size differences, small, large, are almost identical between the species, conveniently. We didn't try to make it that way, but we just kind of picked the smallest and largest that we could find from Melanogaster, and we were interested in this comparison. Well, I guess we selected a Simulans line that was similar to that one. So we have a similar kind of contrast. So we have within and between species, and see if they make their stripes in the same place. So again, we stain them, and we stain them for Eve. So again, we didn't scale these in any way. These are just taken at 20x, and these are all laid into Photoshop. So these are the relative size differences between these embryos. But we stain them for Eve, Giant, and Krupal. Three, and this just shows them as in pairs. This was done earlier. We then developed a way where we could stain for all three of these in one embryo. Originally, we were doing it in these pairs. We initially didn't have the right filters to be able to separate the fluids. But anyway, I'm not going to show you. We've done some genetic analysis of egg size itself between the France and India line within Melanogaster. And it's a nice genetic trait, beautiful quantitative trait, a large number of loci of small effect. When you do the analysis, it looks like that. It's maternal, as you might expect. That is to say, the mother makes the egg. It doesn't matter what the father's genotype is going to be. She makes the egg, and the egg is going to reflect her genotype, not the zygote's, not the embryo's genotype. right? The embryo's genotype actually doesn't even matter in the early steps of embryogenesis. It's not until sort of, you know, you get the zygotic gene expression that it starts to matter. But so egg size is a maternal trait. We didn't try to estimate, but you can do these crosses, you produce F1s. So if you start with two lines that are genetically homozygous, but different, they have different egg sizes, it's genetic, you make F1s. The F1s are all genetically identical, right? But presumably intermediate. Actually, you have to look at the F2 embryos to see what the F1 genotype produces, because it's a maternal trait. So they should be intermediate in size, all of them. They are. Then in the next generation, you can get segregation of the different factors. And depending on how much of a spread you get in that next generation, you can actually estimate the number of loci. And this has kind of all the hallmarks. But other people have done this as well. Large number of loci, of small effect, largely additive, nice, well-behaved quantitative trait, except it's maternally inherited. I wouldn't say, yeah. By large, I probably mean more than two. Yes. Well, again, you know, you look for in those, you make the F1s, you look at the F2 embryos, that tells you what the F1 genotype is. You're asking whether or not it's right at the midpoint between the two parents' sizes or not. So you can estimate dominance, and in the advanced generation, you can estimate other components of quantitative variation. You can estimate epistatic components, depending on the comparisons you make. You can do F2, you can do back crosses, and each one of those, the contrasts allow you to estimate different components of a class quantitative model. But I'm really just pointing out, but this is quite well known. These, at least all this is showing that these two strains sort of behave the way you'd expect. There's nothing weird about them. They just, you know, they've evolved egg size difference. There's probably a number of loci involved. That's the point. No. No one's, and we're interested in actually doing that. It's a nice adaptive trait, and it's been ignored almost entirely. So, again, I just want to point out, I showed you how you can use the cellularization, how much that membrane has moved up in the cortex to estimate age. Reinitz also looks at the extent to which these different transcription factors have kind of evolved their patterns of expression as well to classify into developmental stages. And this just shows you, we're going to analyze a lot of these embryos for where they're making their stripes, okay? They differ in size. We want to make sure we control for developmental stage because stripes move with stage. And these different strains may be developing at slightly different rates or something. So we use both that cortex, the cellularization, how far the membranes move, and this kind of scheme to classify all the embryos we analyze as belonging to one of these different age classes, each probably different by around each 6 or 8 minutes in development. So here's the results. These show what we measured is the anterior and posterior boundaries of all 7 eave stripes. So there's 14 measurements, the anterior, posterior stripe 1, anterior, posterior stripe 2, 3, 4, 5, through 7, okay? Here's the eave stripes, anterior, posterior. These are the different lines. We also looked at W111A, it's just a lab stock. So we have 3 melanogaster lines, actually, India, France, and this W111A, which also produces a relatively small embryo. So there's actually and these are absolute distances from the anterior of the embryo. So we're just measuring how far from the anterior are these stripes. These are the two large embryo strains we have. One of them is France within melanogaster. This is the Seychellia. Both of them, and on this axis, what we plotted is the deviation of the stripes from the mean of all the experiments. The actual distances are very small. And this is just a way of displaying the results to kind of push them apart, to be able to visualize them. It's just a visualization tool. These are the standard errors of our measurements. We measured 50 embryos for each, in each of these lines. So this is the average position of stripe 1 in Seychellia. And this is the standard error of our measurement. The standard error corresponds to about a third of a cell diameter. Surprisingly accurate. I mean, we couldn't believe how well-behaved these are, in some sense. Okay? And they don't differ much. We have not yet tried to count the number of cells, okay, to know if there actually are some differences in the number of cells. To a first approximation, we have looked at some cell sizes, and they're pretty similar. But I don't know a lot. We haven't analyzed that enough yet to know. Yes. Yeah. And these are at exact. So what we've done in this analysis, we've actually, you show these beautiful pictures. But the amount of work is immense because for every one of these, we collect 50 embryos. Okay. For those 50 embryos, you stain some untold number. Because you collect embryos from flies, females, over a couple hour period. You let them lay eggs over a couple hour period. Actually, development can actually occur inside the female. So even when she lays her eggs, that's not time zero. In fact, they can retain their eggs, and you can get almost nearly completely developed embryos out of the female. So you get a wide range of ages of embryos, but you let a whole bunch of females lay eggs for a while, you collect embryos, and among them, some of them are in this, well, we have 5 times 6, about a 30-minute window development period. So you screen 1,000 embryos that have been stained, you try to find a couple of hundred that are developmentally in the right window of time to make these kind of measurements, and then we classify them as being in one of those 5 different stages. Then you put them on slides, right? And Steve said, cover slip on, and they use a penny, we do something slightly different, but you flatten the embryo a little bit. When you put the cover slip on, they roll, and they're not necessarily in the right orientation. And they look quite different if they're belly up or belly down. And so you want to get these measurements, you'd like them to be in the same orientation. So you screen through a whole slide full of these embryos, and you find a few that are in the right orientation. And those are the ones you take a picture of. So you do an awful lot of work to find these 50 that do the analysis. One thing of biasing the analysis, it's just you need to look at a lot to find the ones that are correctly oriented and correctly staged. But quite nice. The big embryos put their stripes more posteriorly. In this direction means more posterior, more anterior. So all three of the small size eggs put them this more anteriorly and these posteriorly, which you would expect if there is a scaling going on. The embryos are bigger. This is absolute distance. This is just absolute distance. So they're putting them further back. So here's, this just shows. Here's the statistical significance of stripe positioning. There's, on absolute measurements, the big embryos within and between species are putting their stripes in places. Here's the scaling. So now scaled embryo length. So it's the same measurements, now you're just scaling to the length of the embryo. And here now is the big embryo from Melanogaster, so that's the India line. It was up here. It collapses. It actually, kind of relative to everything else, now is slightly anteriorly shifted, but very much in line with the other two melanogaster lines. Here's the three melanogaster lines, 1, 2, 3. The red is simulans, okay? Seychellia continues to put its stripes more posteriorly, even on a relative scaling. And when you do the statistical analysis, very clear. Here's the blue line down here. Here's a statistical significance of stripe positioning within melanogaster. So this is just comparing stripe positioning within these three lines, taking into account the standard errors of the measurements. Here's the statistical significance. In other words, all those melanogaster lines, the big line, the small line, scale to embryo length, put their stripes in exactly the same place. That's what this is saying. And statistically speaking, all scale to embryo size, melanogaster has sort of solved the problem, and they scale perfectly. Now, how it scales, I mean, what the molecular mechanism for that is, I don't really know. And this is just the beginning of this project. I'm just kind of showing you the results. But so Shelia puts it in a different place, and here's the statistical significance between the three species, so the three melanogaster lines against simulin and Seychellia, and is very highly statistically significant. So the different species actually don't put their stripes in exactly the same place. They put them in slightly different places, okay? And, oh, let me just show you. If this gives you an idea of the magnitude of the difference. What Susan did is she just searched and found embryos that were staged essentially identically, and then she just rescaled them to be the same size and overlaid them. Here's a melanogaster, false colored in blue, simulin, Seychellia. So you can kind of get some idea of what the magnitude of those shift in stripes are. But the Seychellia is in green, and the melanogaster is in blue. And you can see, especially in the middle region, there's the stripes are displaced by several cells. Okay, that's the magnitude. And we also analyzed the giant stripes and the cupule stripes and got exactly the same results with them. So I don't want to talk about them. Perhaps this is quite interesting, but we asked whether the stripes co-vary. That is to say, within a species, all the stripes within seem to scale quite nicely. But in any individual embryo, there's a certain measurement error. So a stripe might be a little bit anterior to the mean of that line, and some stripes might be a little bit posterior. That's what gives the standard errors of our measurements. Not every embryo has stripes in exactly the same place as best we can measure it. Maybe it's purely just measurement error, how we laid down the ruler to find where the edges of the stripes are. The stripe boundary is a little bit fuzzy, so one might expect a certain amount of measurement noise. But the question is this. Let's say the difference from embryo to embryo within a line is just that the bicoid may be a little bit anteriorly or posteriorly displaced at the time of development, then you might expect all the stripes in that individual embryo to be a little more forward or a little more back. So when you see stripe 1 a little bit further back than the mean of that line, maybe stripe 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 are all a little bit back. So we're interested in that. On the other hand, if it's just pure measurement error, then you see no correlation at all. So we wanted to see what the correlation was between these deviations from the line means, okay, at different physical distances. So this is the relative distance between stripes. Here we're looking at adjacent stripes. And this is just all the data put together. And here we're looking at ones that are like stripe 1 versus stripe 7 and ask what the correlation is. If in an individual embryo, stripe 1's a little bit forward, is stripe 7 a little bit forward, a little back, do they move in any kind of correlated way? And there's this beautiful relationship. And this is for all the different spacings. So this is, around here are things that are differing by one stripe position. Stripe 1 versus stripe 2, stripe 2 versus 3, 3 or 4, all the way across the embryo, but they only differ by that relative distance along the embryo. So all the stripes that are very close to one another are very, very highly correlated in sort of the local deviation in the individual embryo. It really just goes down with increasing distances. So you don't get what you'd expect, that sort of if bicoid is varying a little bit from embryo to embryo, but it's more or less maybe more consistent with the idea that there's just local differences that affect one or two stripes, neighboring stripes, so the stripes are kind of jiggling around, adjusting to one another. And it's, a much tighter adjustment for closely spaced stripes, and then kind of gets weaker as you move further and further away. So there's some interesting kind of information in those little individual differences. Okay, I'm going to just finish. I have a couple more slides. I'll show you the analysis, genetic analysis. We also did a genetic analysis crossing that India and France line, okay, out to the F3. So here's India, France, F1, F2, and F3 embryos. Because it's a maternally derived trait, the F3 embryos really read out the F2 maternal genotype. So it's just, you know, normally when you do a genetic analysis, the F2 are interesting. They're the ones that are segregating. So we're interested in asking whether or not there's any, what's going to happen in these F2, F3 embryos is egg size is going to now vary because we're crossing a big egg with a small egg. And those F3 embryos now have F2 mothers with mixtures of genotypes. And we should get some small eggs, some large eggs, some size eggs. And if there's any genetic variability for this kind of scaling these things or maintain the scaling, those might segregate as well. Then you have to see where they segregate apart. Here's the result. First of all, the scaling is maternal. That is to say, if you look at the India line itself against the F1s, they are right on top of each other. The F2s and F3s. So this is, remember, this is within melanogaster. We're just looking at India and France. So there's if you look at the relative positioning of stripes, they're the same. But so these are a genetic analysis of the absolute distances of the stripes. In the F2 and F3 embryos should be intermediate in size, and they have these nice intermediate positioning of absolute distances in stripes. And this shows all the actual embryos we measure. So in the F3 generation. So in the F3 generation, you get segregation of different size embryos. So actually, this is about the size of the France line. This is about the size of the India line. In the F3, we get embryos of all different sizes across the whole spectrum. And these are their relative kind of stripe positions for all. These are just the anterior borders of the seven stripes. The slope goes upward because they scale perfectly with length. So within melanogaster, they solve the egg size problem perfectly, and they do so across a complete distribution of egg lengths, seeing the species. That's the answer here. And they do it really tightly. I mean, these are individual egg measurements, and they all just, the correlations are strikingly good. I'll show you the cross between species. It's not inconsistent with that. It's not. You know what this actually suggests is, it could be that the large egg line has different alleles for where to put the stripes, and they kind of match, so it allows them to do it. The results sort of don't indicate that there's any genetic variation segregating for where they put the stripe. Everything just scales in the same place. It's almost like there's just a built-in physiological developmental mechanism that puts them in the right place. Egg size does segregate. There's no evidence for genetic variation for the scaling. It seems like the scaling is an invariant property of the species across the whole range of egg sizes. Well, everything's getting mixed now. Yeah. Right. That's correct. So. So that's a good point. That's one thing we're specifically looking for, whether the kind of the variance in where they're putting the stripe increases, and there's just no evidence at all for it. So, I mean, the bottom line is it looks like there's a nice built-in mechanism where just melanogaster, or the Drosophila, solve the problem of being able to compensate for egg size, and it does it very nicely across the range of sizes seen.
Do you think this is happening at the level of the bicoid gradient?
We haven't measured the bicoid gradient, And we're, you know, this is what we have so far. So we just, you know, at this point, one could speculate about that. And we're so interested. We want to look at the Bitcoin gradient and a lot of other things in these. You know, we were hoping perhaps that there would be some genetic variation for where they put the stripes and that we'd see some increase in that variance. That's not the way it turned out. It looks like that. But, you know, what comes to our rescue is the between species, because those really do put their stripes in different places. And we analyzed those as well genetically. I told you, you can cross simulans and Seychellia. So now we can do an analysis of where they put their stripes, where they do put them in different places, even scaled to embryo size. Unfortunately, everything I've just showed you, we set up as one big experiment. Kind of a horrific experiment, because we had to look at, we did all these different parental F1, F2, F3, all these lines, all at the same time, and then everything. But the between species, the Sim Seychellii, we only took it out to the F2 generation and not the F3 generation. And we didn't appreciate that there was going to be so strongly maternally inherited, okay, where you really need the F3 embryos. So I'll show you to the F2. But so here are the original parental lines. Now, this is not absolute distance. This is scaled to embryo size. Okay, so this is scaled distances. Simulans and Seychellii have put their stripes, especially in the middle of the embryo, in seemingly slightly different places. We back-crossed to simulans. And the F1s are just like the maternal lineage. So, you know, it's, again, looks like there's a nice maternal trait. And here's the scaled stripe positioning in the F2 embryos. So their mother is F1. She has an F1 genotype between these two species. And she puts her stripes just right in the middle. And these are scaled. This is scaled to embryo size. Now, this is not absolute distance. So that's what we know. So it looks additive anyway. If they're in the middle between two parental lines, it's additive. That's all we can say. It looks like at least the difference between these species also looks maternal and additive. And we're redoing the experiment now to get F3 embryos and also track the genotype at a number of these interesting loci, like Bicoid and things like that, so we can look in individual embryos, see what their genotype is, and where the F3s put their stripes. We don't have those data yet, just doing the experiment. So that's what we have so far. I know it's a good place to stop. The point is, you know, a lot of people are interested in developmental robustness and how well these networks, pathways kind of respond to environmental noise and genetic variation. And certainly egg size is one of those interesting challenges that has both environmental and genetic components. And it looks like there's some interesting difference. I mean, what it's suggesting is that, you know, this trait is beautifully canalized in melanogaster. It always produces everything correctly. But nevertheless, the trait evolves pretty quickly between species. So, our guess is there actually may be genetic variation somehow underlying the trait. It's just suppressed by the canalization mechanism. That would be the classic interpretation of those results. But we're just going to go forward and see what we find. That's a good place to stop, I think.